Okay, well, should I go ahead and begin? Okay. So first I'd like to begin by thanking the organizers of the conference.
Je voudrais vous remercier pour me donner l'opportunité de faire partie de cette conférence. C'est vraiment un honneur pour moi de pouvoir participer et d'avoir la chance d'apprendre de ce groupe extraordinaire.
I'm grateful for the opportunity to be here and to learn from such a distinguished group of scholars, judges, and others. Thank you very much. Today I will talk about the paucity of women judges on international courts. I will begin by presenting some information about what international courts do and statistics on the percentage of women judges on various international courts. Then I will discuss three potential causes: the pool of available candidates, selection procedures, and finally, advocacy. I will provide a brief conclusion at the end. So first, there are numerous international courts operating in the world today, as I'm sure most of you or all of you know. These are bodies that are created by more than one state to adjudicate disputes involving sovereigns or to determine individual accountability for violations of international criminal law. They include bodies such as the International Court of Justice, the International Criminal Court, the World Trade Organization Dispute Settlement Body, Appellate Body, the Inter-American Court of Human Rights, and the International Tribunal for the Law of the Sea. Their decisions affect our human rights. They affect which states get to exploit what natural resources, when the use of force is prohibited, and when individuals should be held accountable for atrocity crimes. They're located in places as far-flung as Arusha, Tanzania, The Hague, Geneva, and San Jose, Costa Rica. The subject matter jurisdiction, or jurisdiction ratione materiae, of international courts varies substantially. For example, some courts have quite limited subject matter jurisdiction and are charged with interpreting and applying regional human rights instruments, while others span a wide range of different areas of the law, such as the International Court of Justice. They're composed of judges from either the region where the court is based, if it is a regional court, such as the European Court of Human Rights, or from judges from all or of judges from all over the world, if it is a global court, such as the International Criminal Court, the International Court of Justice, the WTO. So who are the judges on these bodies? Well, a 2006 study of 215 international court judges found that 63% came from civil law countries, while 14% came from common law countries, 23% came from mixed common law, civil law, Islamic or local customary law blended with civil or common law traditions. Most international court judges studied law in the top universities in their countries, while many also studied international law, and a large majority had graduate or doctorate degrees from top elite universities, such as Harvard University, Columbia University, the University of Cambridge, the University of London, Oxford University, the University of Paris, and the University of Moscow. International court judges tend to have decades of experience, and they generally hail from three career paths: academia, the national judiciary, or civil service in international organizations or for their own states as diplomats. Now, while they may come from all over the world, the vast majority of international courts are not representative when it comes to gender. So I chose to gather statistics on 13 different regional and global courts. I chose these courts because they span a wide range of subject matters and regions in the world. The data that I'll be presenting is drawn from court websites or publications from October 2013, so last month. I did not look at ad hoc investment or trade arbitral panels for today's presentation. But I did do that research in 2009, and I found at the time that only 9% of the arbitrators for the International Center for the Settlement of Investment Disputes were women, and 17% of WTO panel members were women. Those statistics are also a little bit tricky because, for example, on ICSID, there's like three women that do all the arbitrations. So they're all nominated over and over and over again. So it's actually less than it appears at first glance. So this first slide shows the statistics on the six global courts that I looked at. You can see the number of women out of the total in the top row. And I looked at permanent women judges in October 2013. So I didn't focus on the ad litem or ad hoc judges. And I also listed the state of origin for the women judges. So we have International Court of Justice, Law of the Sea Tribunal, International Criminal Court, the Yugoslav Tribunal, the Rwandan Tribunal, and the WTO appellate body. There's a few interesting points that are noteworthy here. The first is that the ICC is the court with the highest percentage of women judges. 10 out of 17, or 59% of them, are women. This is the only court that I've ever been able to find at the international level that has more women than men on the bench. Next comes, astoundingly, the International Court of Justice. Now, why do I say astoundingly? Because until 2006, there had never been a female judge on the International Court of Justice. That is when Rosalind Higgins became a member of the bench. Since her departure, three more women have joined the bench, the second, third, and fourth women ever to serve on the ICJ in its 60-year history. The Law of the Sea Tribunal had the lowest percentage of women judges of any global international court. Only recently did one woman get elected to the bench, and that's Elsa Kelly from Argentina. Another interesting point here is if you look at where the women come from. So on the global courts, the women tend not to be from the US, Canada, or Western Europe, with a few exceptions. Now, we're not talking about a huge sample size here, so that's, you know, one factor to take into account. There aren't that many women overall. And also, it's important to note that not all states are parties to each of these courts. So, for example, the U.S. could not have a judge on the International Criminal Court because it is not a party to the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court. But nonetheless, it's still striking, I think, to see that the vast majority of the women judges do not come from Western Europe or the US or Canada. Now here is a slide of the statistics on seven regional courts. Inter-American Court of Human Rights, European Court of Human Rights, African Court of Human and People's Rights, European Court of Justice, Andean Court, Caribbean Court, and ECOWAS, or the Economic Community of West African States, Community Court of Justice. Try saying that very quickly. Okay, so the best court here in terms of the percentage of women judges is the ECOWAS court. Three of the seven judges are women. And then the second best is the European Court of Human Rights, with 17 of 46 judges, or 37% female judges. The worst court is the Inter-American Court of Human Rights, which currently has no women judges whatsoever sitting on it. It used to have three on it at the same time, but that was a few years ago. But overall, only a handful of women have served on the Inter-American Court of Human Rights. Now here is a bar graph of the percentage of permanent women judges on all of the global and regional courts that I looked at. I looked to see if regional courts were better on average than global courts, and I did not find that to be the case. They seem to be quite similar. I also looked at subject matter jurisdiction, or jurisdiction ratione materiae, to see if that makes a difference, like if it's a human rights court or an economic court or an international humanitarian law court. But there doesn't seem to be a relationship between subject matter and the percentage of permanent female judges there either. So the takeaway here is that on average, 22% of international court judges are women, and the overall range is from 0 on the Inter-American Court to 59% on the ICC. Okay, so why are there such low numbers of women? Oops, that's not the right slide. Sorry about that. So why are there such low numbers of women judges on international courts? Well, I've identified 3 possible causes. There are a limited pool of candidates, flawed selection procedures, and a lack of advocacy around sex representativeness on international court benches. So the first reason for the paucity of women judges pertains to the pool of available candidates for international judgeships. The fact is that there are not as many women as men in the legal profession globally. International court judges are drawn from the top of the legal profession, and as we have seen in, I think, every presentation today, women are generally found at lower numbers at the highest levels of the legal profession. According to a recent study by Ethan Michelson, only 36% of the world's lawyers are women, and 36% of all countries have fewer than 30% female lawyers. Even though many countries have high percentages of female lawyers, as we've seen today, they're not necessarily in the most prestigious parts of the profession. So for example, in the UK, only 35% of practicing barristers and 11% of Queen's Counsel in 2010 were women, according to Bar Council statistics. And this I found to be one of the most striking statistics I've come across in my scholarship. In 2003, nearly 60% of law schools in the UK had never had a female professor, and 83% of all law professors were men. Now, those statistics are from 2003, and you know, there may have been some changes, but from my consultation with Kate Mallison, it appears that there has not been a huge change in that number. A 2003 book examining women in the legal profession from a comparative perspective, co-edited by Ulrike Schultz and Shaw, found that women were underrepresented in the most lucrative sectors and highest echelons of the profession in most countries surveyed, including Canada, Australia, New Zealand, the UK, Israel, Germany, Holland, Poland, France, and Japan. And studies reached the same conclusions or similar conclusions in South Africa and the US. Further, although lower levels of the judiciary in many countries are increasingly feminized, men continue to be significantly overrepresented in most countries, especially at the intermediate and highest court levels. So you can't see this very well, I'm sure, from the back, but if you want more information about the status of women as judges on domestic courts at the highest levels, the 2011-2012 UN Progress of the World's Women report has those statistics in it, so you can see sort of where things fall. So Serbia, Rwanda, Canada, FYR Macedonia, Slovenia are towards the top, and at the bottom we've got Andorra, Cameroon, Cape Verde, Hungary, Malaysia, Pakistan, Peru, just to have a sense of what we're talking about. Okay, so scholars have identified numerous causes, and we've talked about some of those today, for the low numbers of women lawyers at the highest levels of the profession. At the domestic level, ranging from the inflexible structure of work environments, of specific work environments such as large private law firms, to shouldering a disproportionate burden of familial responsibilities, to opting out to care for family, to preferring increased flexibility, to outright discrimination. The paucity of women judges in domestic courts in some countries, or at the highest levels of the profession in most countries, make the pool of candidates available at the international level even smaller. There are some additional challenges that pertain specifically to international courts. For example, to be on an international court, you probably have to move to another country or spend significant amounts of time in another country, and that may be challenging in light of familial or community obligations. And the extent to which women are present at the bars of these courts may also have an impact on the diversity of the bench. For example, anyone who has had any experience whatsoever with the International Court of Justice knows that the lack of diversity in every way among its oral advocates is shocking. Shocking. There's no other word for it but shocking. So even if the career path of an international judge does not necessarily include serving as a litigator before it, the lack of diversity on the bench and at the bar may contribute to some kind of culture of complacency. That is, the lack or paucity of women may make the problem itself sort of invisible. Although the pool of women may be smaller or even significantly smaller than the pool of available men, the pool is on its own insufficient to explain the paucity of women judges on international courts. So for example, there are no women on the Inter-American Court of Human Rights, yet there are many able and renowned human rights advocates who are women in the Americas. Similarly, on the Law of the Sea Tribunal, there are many able and renowned women who could serve on that tribunal, yet there's only one of 21 on the bench. So even with a smaller pool, it's reasonable to posit that women are not reflected in proportion to their availability. A second potential cause for low numbers of women judges on international courts is selection procedures. Now, I hesitate to focus on selection procedures because studies of selection procedures and their impacts appear to be very fickle and inconclusive. So in the US, numerous scholars have compared selection procedures on state courts. And they've looked at things like, well, is it more likely that women or people of color will make it onto the bench if merit commissions are used, or if there are direct elections? And conclusions are quite difficult to draw because the procedures being compared are themselves varied, and the results of these studies are frequently inconsistent. That said, some of the literature points to the conclusion that when merit selection is used, it can help women and people of color onto the bench when the commissions themselves are diverse and play a role in seeking out diverse candidates. On most international courts, the general rule is that states or groups of states nominate candidates, usually with little to no participation from the public. And those candidates get voted on by an assembly of state parties. It's more of a tap on the shoulder system than a concours or open competition for the best candidate. So a few authors describe the selection process as, quote, as in any political matter, the heart of the story often lies in handshakes and conversations that are off the political record, end quote. And such methods of selection lead to cronyism rather than merit-based determination. And also, they likely perpetuate the power of the groups already in power, as we have also discussed already today in various different contexts. Another important point with respect to selection procedures is that where there are gender representativeness requirements in the statutes of international courts, they seem to make a difference in sex representativeness. So most or all international courts have geographic representation requirements or require there to be a number of different legal traditions represented, and a few courts have these gender representation requirements. So for example, the ICC, which I mentioned has the highest percentage of women judges, has and also the most transparent selection procedure I've been able to find in my research. So how does it work there? Well, state parties nominate candidates to the Secretariat of the Assembly of State Parties, or the ASP, and those nominations have to include information about how the candidate meets the requirements laid out in the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court. So, for example, states have to say, this person is a specialist in criminal law, which is a List A topic, or this person has relevant knowledge in international law, which is a List B topic. And then they also have to take into account geographic representation, a fair representation of male and female judges, and the need for expertise on violence against women and children. And all of that information that the state party prepares is put on the internet, on the ICC website, so that people can look at it. And NGOs have actually interviewed people who have been candidates for the ICC. This is completely different from the way that people are nominated to other international courts. Also, an Assembly of State Parties resolution requires that more than twice the number of candidates necessary to meet the gender and geographical representation requirements be nominated. And then a ballot is only valid if the state votes for a predetermined number of judges from List A and List B, and as many as are required for geographic representativeness, and a minimum number of judges of each gender. To add even more, they just made a change that they created an advisory committee to evaluate the merits of the candidates and provide that information to the states that are voting. I took a look yesterday at the list of people on the advisory committee, and I was sort of surprised and interested to see that only one of the 10 or 11 people on the advisory committee was a woman, which seems sort of inconsistent with the beautiful story I've been telling about the ICC so far. Now, after the Rome Statute was concluded, the Security Council of the UN added in gender representativeness requirements for ad litem judges on the Yugoslav Tribunal and on the Rwandan Tribunal, but only for ad litem judges, not for permanent judges. And if you look at the statistics there, it's also interesting. So the current numbers, I think, are somewhat deceiving because the courts are winding down their business. So I've looked at the historic numbers here. And if you look at former ad litem judges, 42% are women. If you look at former permanent judges, 23% are women on the ICTY. On the ICTR, there's a similar disparity between the permanent and the ad hoc judges. On the European Court of Human Rights, in 2004, the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe stated it would no longer consider unisex lists of candidates to the ECHR, and currently 37% of the judges on the ECHR are women. Now, somewhat of an exception here is the African Court on Human and People's Rights, which also has a gender representativeness requirement, and it only has 18% women on the bench. So four of the five courts that have these provisions have had a higher than average percentage of women judges on the bench. Now, one question to consider when we get to the legitimacy part of this conference is, why is it that only human rights courts and international criminal courts have gender representativeness requirements and not the others? And is representation necessary for all kinds of courts or just courts of some specific kind of subject matter jurisdiction? Okay, so my last argument is on advocacy. So one reason for the paucity of women judges on international courts is that most people probably don't know about them or don't think about them or don't care about them. People care more about and are more willing to mobilize about what's happening at the local level in front of them, who's deciding cases that they think impact them directly. So in discussing President Carter's advancement of women on the federal bench in the US, Sally Kenney has pointed out that change occurs when people mobilize, especially strategically placed insiders collaborating with outside groups. And the reason that the ICC has a gender representativeness requirement is because people mobilized for that, they lobbied for that. And the same goes for the ICTY and the ICTR. At the international level, people are starting to make arguments about why gender representativeness matters, but I have not heard anyone decry the fact that there are zero women on the Inter-American Court of Human Rights, or that there's one woman on the Law of the Sea Tribunal. And if nobody mobilizes at the domestic level, where the choices are made about who to nominate, and nobody mobilizes at the international level, then nothing will happen to diversify the judiciary. So, where does this leave us all? Well, first, it highlights the importance of what we're doing here today, which is to talk about the paucity of women judges, to name it as a problem, and to explain why it is a problem in a way that's compelling and interesting to people beyond this room, because otherwise we're left standing alone on this issue. Second, it means that we need to take a much closer look at selection processes on international courts. By looking at these different statutes and outcomes, we can learn a lot about this. And once we've convinced people why the underrepresentation of women judges matters, and we've identified the reforms we believe are useful to effectuate change, we need to develop some sort of mobilization strategy for implementing those changes. So this is a slide of fabulous women judges on international courts from all over the world. And I've put it up to inspire us to move ahead with this project. So again, I'm grateful for the opportunity to be a part of this discussion with you, and thank you very much for your attention. Thank you.
Merci beaucoup, professeur Resnick et professeur Grossman, pour ces présentations qui ont tracé encore une fois un bilan statistique, mais extrêmement contextualisé de la présence des femmes dans des juridictions extrêmement importantes. Et on retiendra évidemment votre affirmation que l'absence de femmes est probablement un marqueur d'inégalité, mais que la présence des femmes n'est pas un marqueur forcément d'égalité. Je pense qu'on pourra en reparler lors de la table ronde et certainement demain. Je sens des gens déjà qui veulent avoir une conversation. Donc, on pourra commencer la conversation immédiatement à la pause café. Et après cette pause, je disparais. Quelqu'un d'autre prend la relève de la table ronde de l'après-midi et on aura par la suite une discussion plus globale avec la salle. Voilà. Merci beaucoup encore une fois de votre participation.